chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them.
But we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing. Whom I love? Think a moment. Think of me. Me whom the plainest woman would despise. Whom should I love? Why, of course, it must be the woman in the world most beautiful. This is a quote from the 1898 Edmund Rostand play, Cyrano de Bergerac, from the production notes of the film we're talking about this week. Eliza, we're going back to theater. We're going back to our roots, and I could not be more excited.
I know. I'm excited, too. There's something about going back that just, you gotta love it.
Yeah, I feel like both of our, like, nerdiest sides are about to come out. Not that that's something that's not on display every week, but especially this month.
This is a different kind of nerdy side. But yeah, we are doing Cyrano de Bergerac month, which is going to get interesting.
Yeah, like, there's a part of me that thinks, like, maybe for us this feels like a really thematic idea, but for others they're like, Cyrano de Whatawack?
Right.
What month is this
going to be? Right, like, maybe this is less obvious to others. Early on when we were coming up with ideas for the podcast, we immediately started talking about adaptation movies because, of course, we did. And we're Shakespeare nerds and Jane Austen nerds. So, of course, all of those were coming up. And in that first discussion, I was like, also, we could do Cyrano movies because there's so many Cyrano movies. And if that doesn't tell you what kind of a nerd I am, I was like, oh, rom-coms. Obviously, we have to do all of the Cyrano movies.
But I mean, you're so right. And I think if we get anything out of this month, it's going to be telling the world, or rather reminding the world, that, yeah, if you don't know Cyrano de Bergerac, you actually do, because you have undoubtedly seen a movie, a TV show, an opera, an anything based on this very famous plot.
So we're going to start off. I think anyone who does know what we're talking about would assume that this is where we're going to have to go, because this is the obvious choice and the best choice. We are going to start off today by talking about the movie Roxanne. I've had that song stuck in my head all week, the Moulin Rouge version. It has nothing to do with this movie, but it's what's in my head right now.
But the time period is right, because that's relatively like belly pox. So that all, your brain is doing some really smart intertextual work.
Yeah, that's definitely what's happening.
All right, let's talk about a Google summary here. Yes, we're talking about Roxanne, 1987. Here's your Google summary. In this modern take on Edmund Rostand's classic play, Cyrano de Bergerac, C.D. Bales, played by Steve Martin, is the witty, intelligent, and brave fire chief of a small Pacific Northwest town who, due to the size of his enormous nose, declines to pursue the girl of his dreams, lovely Roxanne Kowalski, played by Daryl Hannah. Instead, when his shy underling, Chris McConnell, played by Rick Rossovich, becomes smitten with Roxanne, C.D. Bales feeds the handsome young man the words of love to win her heart. All right. First Cyrano movie. Eliza, this is what Google says Roxanne is about. But what is it really about?
You know, I think I'm going to give probably the most wholesome answer I've ever given to this question in this episode. I think what this movie is really about is sort of the ethereal magic of words and interpersonal connection.
Oh, I love that. I totally agree. Like, the original play was written in rhyming verse in, I believe it's Alexandriac verse.
Yes.
So the movie really does, like, lean so hard into its love for wordplay and literature. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and the movie stars Steve Martin, and he also wrote the screenplay and was one of the producers. And you can tell that he has a love for the source material and for what it's about and where it comes from. Because while obviously the movie is quite different, just putting it in a modern setting and not having it be, you know, in verse makes it obviously like a very different thing, entity. But that same sort of overarching love for the words and the language and the big ideas behind them, even in this relatively simple comedy, it's all there. And you can tell that he really understands the importance of that to the story.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I find so impressive about this, because I didn't know before I watched this that he was the screenplay writer. But the adaptation, and to be very clear, I know of Cyrano de Bergerac. I know the reputation of it. I know the rough plot summary, but I've never actually read it. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, though, in the adaptation, Steve Martin's made some really smart choices as part of his sort of like reverence for the play itself, which is interesting because he keeps a lot of the language. He keeps a lot of the turns of phrase from the French to English translation. But I didn't know this, Eliza. This film is the first adaptation of Cyrano de Bergerac to have a happy ending because the play has a tragic ending.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like a lot of the versions of Cyrano that we get these days are like this, in that the Cyrano character and the one he's wooing end up together. And that's not what happens in the play, which is, I find it funny that this play that does not have a happy and romantic, in modern terms, romantic ending, has become so sort of ever present in our contemporary consciousness as a love story when it's not really right. In that kind of a way.
Well, I was gonna say, and it's really smart the way Steve Martin kind of pairs it down to its most romantic part, because you know, I'm gonna be putting on my theater history professor hat a lot in this episode, so I'm sorry to everyone who's listening. But this play comes from a period called the early, or I shouldn't say the early modern period, because that's a historical thing, but it is the prime period of what we call modern theater. And that was the time of the well-made five-act play. And the Rostand play is that, you know, it has like a series of events. They're all happening all the time. There's like five subplots. There's a million characters. It's like super big. It's a huge play with a lot going on. But Steve Martin pares it down to just this like very romantic plot about writing letters and, you know, mistaken identity. And like you said, like wooing through language. I think that was a really smart and very romantic choice.
Yeah. And it's interesting because he cuts out a lot of the actual plot details from the original Cyrano, which, like you said, has a much more complex plot with a lot of additional surrounding characters. But he keeps elements of a lot of those plot details that he cuts as well. You know, he makes the main character, C.D. Bales, who's the Cyrano stand-in, and his people be the fire department in this town. And in the original piece, they are soldiers, right? They're various cadets and whatnot. But that functions in the original piece as, because they are soldiers, there's a whole sort of like honor element, and that's their, you know, important place in society and blah, blah, blah. But it's also a job, right? That, you know, some of them do because they need work, and some of them do because they're wealthy and it's something to do. And by making them firefighters in the town, the fire department, there's an element of respect to him being the fire chief, but there's also a lot of his employees are not particularly good at their job. So then there's some comedy elements that he can incorporate there. But it's a good sort of stand-in in that you already understand his place in the town when it's clear from the beginning that he's the fire chief and he's well-loved in town. So he's someone in a, you know, slight position of power and privilege, but he's not like the mayor or the richest guy in town or anything like that. Like it positions him in a way that's quite clear. And I think in its own way, very related to the 100 years, 400 years earlier, sorry, the 400 years earlier version of what Cyrano was in his society.
Yeah, that's true. Like, it really gives him a place of relatable respect in this town that makes sense. Like, some of my favorite moments of comedy in the film, if you haven't seen the film, listeners, is there are lots of times where people will say, like, don't talk about the nose. Don't do it. Trust me. And I did not expect that your consequences for talking about his nose was to get your ass beat, which is hilarious to me. This movie opens with Steve Martin basically fencing two bros, like 80s versions of bros, with a tennis racket. And it is absolutely delightful, everyone. Please go watch this movie for that scene alone.
Well, it's so funny. One of the things that I think makes this movie work so well, and I think is one of the things that makes, even though it's very 80s, makes it still work today, is that it's quite comical. And I don't just mean funny, I mean sort of animated comical, right? Like he's, when he has these fights, it's choreographed so that he's kicking these guys' asses, but the sound effects are like literal Looney Tunes Animaniacs style sound effects, right? Like he punches them and there's like a kind of sound, you know, and there's, he has all these ridiculous things where he like punches behind him really easily. And it's very animated and very over the top. And then anytime he sees Roxanne, there's these like big swelling love music themes that come in with the like 80s sax and soft piano. And it's so over the top and ridiculous in this otherwise quite understated movie. And I think that does sort of, it works in the movie's favor because it's a movie that is very much grounded in reality, but just slightly heightened emotions within an otherwise realistic setting. And so you're able to like not get too distracted by the 80s-ness of it all or the sappiness of it all or any of that because of all these sort of silly elements that are thrown in.
Yeah, and I think that's a lovely tribute to the original source text and what a lot of sort of classic romantic comedies on stage are like, right? That they are very realistic, but they have the moments of heightened drama and theatricality are quite big, right? The comedy mm-hmm. is big, the romance is big. Yeah, and it's very charming. And I think it's charming in a way that I think a lot of modern romantic comedies are not because they don't necessarily take their cues from that tradition.
Right. And this movie skirts the line of being a lot of things that would make it much worse. You know, it almost is of the sappiness level of like a Nicholas Sparks movie or a love story kind of movie or whatever, but it doesn't quite go there. And if you heightened the comedy and the physical comedy and the Steve Martin bits a little bit more, you'd be leaning more towards the jerk kind of situation, right? Or a frat humor kind of movie. And it's not that either. So it sort of sits happily in the middle of a lot of things and manages to find a balance in a way that is quite difficult and pretty impressive.
Yeah, and I think amongst that too is that my whole thing about rom-coms is that I get frustrated that they oftentimes position themselves as sort of these like folk wisdom pamphlets for how to date and what romance should be. And I think there are some degree to which the Cyrano de Bergerac story is imparting a moral about love, but it really is careful, the movie is, I think, about making it about these specific characters in these specific circumstances and not making it about sweeping grand statements about what romance is supposed to be, per se.
Sure.
But maybe it is. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I definitely think that the characters are, they're all unique, right? They all are, yes, they're tropes, you know, all movies have tropes, but there are things that make each character that character specifically, and they all work together because they are those particular characters, which doesn't always happen in some of the more modern rom-coms, you know, especially sort of those early 2000s where like you could literally replace any female character from any of those movies with another female character and change none of the details and it would still work. These characters do have like actual, you know, specific character traits and relationships and quirks that all sort of work or don't work together. And so because of that, it doesn't feel as much like it's a big statement about love and dating in general, because it is much more about these individuals. But, you know, I mean, there's a few sort of overarching concepts. Don't lie, communicate better, you know, things like that, like are woven into it. But the problems are a little more specific to this story.
Is it trying to talk about like intelligence is better than looks? I don't know if it is saying that, although it could be interpreted that way, which is interesting. Like Chris, who's our rival for CD's affections for Roxanne, he's not. I think it, like you said, in an early 2000s movie, he probably would have been a jerk. Or we would have found out he was a jerk somehow. And he is. But mostly his overveiling problem is that he's dumb. That he's like a lovable dummy. Who is really superficial and overly sexual.
Well, but the thing is, I don't think that the movie criticizes him for that. It just says that he's not a good match for Roxanne. And in fact, the inherent flaw that both he and Roxanne have is that they fall for each other based solely on looks and not on their interactions. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I really love about this movie, and if you haven't watched this, this is a slight spoiler for the end, but Roxanne has a friend in town who's also friends with CD, who is a barmaid. She's a bartender at the local watering hole. And she likes being a cocktail waitress. She has no big aspirations beyond that. She wants to get out of their small town and go to like Reno or Tahoe and, you know, and that kind of thing. But she likes being a cocktail waitress and she likes talking to people at the bar and that kind of stuff. And that's sort of, that's what her aspirations are. And she ends up with the dummy character. He's like charming and lovely, but not super intellectual and likes to travel and meet people and hang out and talk. And so they start talking and realize that they have really great chemistry. And ultimately the two of them run away together. And it's not like, here's this idiot and this other idiot. They got together in the end. It's here's these two people who, you know, book smarts and intellectualism are not what's important to them, but relationships and kindness and adventure and, you know, that kind of thing is. And so they found each other and they're happy together. And then here we have Roxanne and CD, who both, you know, like reading big books with big ideas and looking into the sky and talking about astronomy and, you know, and waxing poetic to each other in order to share their emotions. And so they end up together because that fits. It's much less about whether or not it's important to be smart and much more about actually being the right fit for the person you're trying to woo.
Right, you're right. And that's why the whole lesson about like being yourself and being honest is important, because it underlies that idea. Like, you can't be with the person who's right for you if you're trying to be someone you're not.
Yeah.
That's true. It's a very loving moral.
And I do think that in getting to that moral, they have a lot of different women in this movie who are all positioned in quite different ways and yet are all given the same sort of respect by the movie itself. And I really like that. I feel like, you know, there's not like the dumb best friend or the wise older woman who, you know, blah, blah. Everyone just kind of is a real person in this social circle. And you even get male-female relationships, which, you know, friendships, which feel quite authentic and lovely as well. And I just feel like a lot of movies don't manage to accomplish all of those things. So it's nice that they found that balance.
Yeah, I had many like different thoughts about Roxanne as a character in that. Mm-hmm. Because she's so interesting to me amongst these women, you know, some of whom are friends with CD, some of them, you know, don't know him as well or whatever. But I was interested in how they position her intelligence, because there is one way you could look at this where you see Roxanne as a character who is very, like you said, book smart. You know, she's an astronomer. She's there doing research. But she's like life dumb in a way, because she's so taken in by Chris and his looks. And she even earlier on in the film mentions that there was a guy that she had been seeing before, but he wasn't going to come up to town to visit her. They'd broken up because they ran out of gas because she mistook sex for love.
So, which leads to a great line where the cocktail waitress character says, "Oh, I've done that. It's so much fun."
I loved that line. I was immediately like, I'm worried about this movie. Never mind. This movie's going to be fine. But I do think that there's a space to interpret Roxanne in that way, though, that there's nearly a rom-com trope there about a woman who doesn't know how to have relationships and then a man teaches her how to have relationships. It doesn't go all the way there, but the potential for it is there.
Well, and we've seen movies that begin with that trope and then do take it to too far of an example. Yes. You know, I'm going to bring this up because if we're talking about Cyrano things, this is a great example. The Ugly Truth, which is a terrible movie. It's fun, but it's truly terrible. Katherine Heigl is the Roxanne character, and she's that 2000s over the top version of this character, right? She's very smart and very capable, but she has no real life experience and she can't get a man, even though she's freaking Katherine Heigl. And she's like, no, men don't find me pretty enough and I'm too intimidating. I just don't know how to interact. I don't even know how to talk to the cute doctor who lives next door to me. You know, and she feels so fake. And this movie, Roxanne, takes that character and doesn't push her over the top. And so it's just like a normal character trait that a human woman might have of, okay, maybe she doesn't have the best judgment when it comes to relationships, rather than like, I've managed to become a successful TV producer, but I don't know how to interact with humans.
That's so true. I did really appreciate that she's like an intellectual academic who's like also a relatable and normal human, because as a legit academic, I don't really see a lot of wholesome and realistic portrayals of academics in media. So this is really, especially women academics. Hello.
No, absolutely. Really, I think having this woman who, you know, has friends in town, but also has to leave town to go to like a symposium at a university because she's won some award and has really big ideas and goals for herself, but also just like wants friendships and a relationship and a nice house in a cute town in Colorado, right? Like it that shouldn't be such a rare characterization to see, but it still is.
Yeah. And like, I think the only time where I sort of like had my eyebrows raised, but I'm curious about this because you may know more about this than I do. Mm-hmm. The first time we're introduced to Roxanne and she gets locked out of her house through some wacky French farce hijinks, nude, and has to be saved by CD while she is, you know, nude and hiding in some bushes. Mm-hmm. I was at first, because that's our first introduction to her, I was like, oh God, who is this character about to be? Like, I'm so concerned about where we're going with this. Mm-hmm. But that's the last time they really characterize her that way, or as mm-hmm. like life stupid, or as overly sexualized. So I was wondering if that comes from the play. Is that a riff on a moment in the play? Do you know?
That I don't actually know. I certainly, from what I do know of the play, I don't believe there is any scene where she's naked.
That would be hard to pull off.
Yeah. I don't know if maybe she's more subtly, but at the time, overtly sexualized in the play. I think that this is just an 80s need to get Daryl Hannah out of her clothes. But what I found interesting about it, which is two things. One, I think actually that scene ultimately does help to establish the relationship between her and CD, because he acknowledges that there is a naked woman standing in the bushes, but does not actually sexualize her. And in fact, the two of them, as they're walking back to her house with her like jumping behind bushes to get there, are bantering back and forth and telling jokes and introducing each other. And then when he finally gets her in back into her house, he just like cuts up some apples and some bread and sits down and chats with her. And so it establishes very quickly, one, that they have a good rapport, but also, two, that he does not see himself as a sexual being, and so does not believe that this woman would ever see him as such, because he doesn't even try to, like, flirt with her in the sexy way, even when she's standing naked, wrapped in a towel right next to him. So for a weird setup, I think it ultimately does kind of help establish who they are together. But I also found it so funny because the other Daryl Hannah movie that we've talked about on this podcast also introduces her as a naked woman, which I don't know what's up with that particular meme happening over and over again with Daryl Hannah. But comparing those two introductions, they are very different.
It's true. It's the same sort of trope, but it's being handled in very different ways.
Yeah.
So it works better and it's more characterizing. And I think you're right. Like what I appreciated about this movie is that rather than sort of painting all men with a broad brush, there's a variety of women. There's a variety of men in this film. Mm-hmm. And some of them have that really characteristic, like tasteless 80s sexualizing language. Like I think there's a scene where Chris first sees Roxanne in the bar, and the guy he's with is like, look over there, you know, look at that pair of legs, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like shocking now, I think, looking back, you know, what this is 35 years ago almost, how brazen their language is. I feel like now you could be that brazen, but someone would probably smack you for it.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's nice to see the contrast in the film there, that there is this kind of like very brazen, sexualizing, masculine romantic approach, and then there's, you know, CD's approach, which is more about intellectualism, language, etc. Not that those things are mutually exclusive, because they're not.
No, but it's nice to see them both represented. And again, the movie, you know, the characters who do sort of say the more kind of overtly sexual you know, dehumanizing things to the women are usually sort of called out, or someone smacks them in the back of the head or rolls their eyes or kind of moves past it. Like, those are not the characters who are succeeding with women. This movie does not give them any sympathy. But it's definitely, it's so interesting that she's introduced as this naked, beautiful blonde woman, helpless and needing to be saved by a man. But it doesn't, it still is so different than in Splash when she is the, you know, born sexy yesterday, just appearing on the beach, standing naked and open, waiting for all men to look upon her. It's much more her sort of fighting against that, saying, okay, I know I need your help and I'm standing here naked, but could you please avert your eyes and get me back into the house and then let's have a real intellectual conversation? Yeah. So it does both provide that sort of summer blockbuster need to have a naked sexy lady and also subvert it at the same time.
Yeah, I feel like that move really puts forward how, or puts to the forefront, that this movie was made by, and this sounds like I'm really putting down other rom-coms, and I am, I guess, but this movie was really made by some very smart, like truly intellectual humans, because normally movies that have plots like this where it's like, the girl goes for the smart guy instead. Like, usually I'm like, oh my God, kill me now with these fake intellectuals and these men who think that women owe them, you know, romance because they think themselves to be quite smart. Boo. Usually in those movies, I get pretty annoyed and I want them to stop. But in this movie, like, it has the real, like, bona fides, you know? Like, I'm looking at this one quote from that balcony scene, which is absolutely, like, delightful, funny, but also, like, really romantic. He has this one line where he says, I'm suspended weightless over you like the blue man in the Chagall, just hovering, hanging in a delirious kiss. And not only is that language gorgeous, it's also referencing, like, it's making some deep cut art history references. Like, whoa.
Right.
Woo.
Yeah, no, he's not, this is not fake intellectualism. He's not just like, oh, and then I mentioned the Mona Lisa, so I know things about art. You know, right? Like, this was written by someone who actually did the research. And it's interesting because Steve Martin, this is one of his first sort of more straight man movies, which is funny because, like, he's obviously a very comedic character in this, but he has said in interviews that this was the first movie where he really felt respected as an actor and a part of the creative process on set rather than just an ex-stand-up who had then made the transition to movies. Mm-hmm. And so I think you can see that in the writing as well. You know, you can see someone who wants to be taken more seriously and who's respecting other people who want to be taken more seriously.
Yeah, I agree. Like, the whole scene with the 20 nose jokes, like, what's so great about that is that it bridges the gap between those two versions of Steve Martin's sort of creative existence. Like, yes, it is him doing the stand-up thing and being really good at it and knowing exactly how to work a room, but it's also, like, the wittiest wordplay and punnery you'll ever see. It's brilliant.
I love in that scene how he keeps classifying each one of the jokes. You know, he's making all of these nose jokes that are better than the jokes others have made at the expense of his nose, but instead of just rattling them off, he says, like, ah, this one's satirical, this one's culinary, this one's dirty, this one's, you know, and it's, you can see his mind working overtime to create these, and the character is clearly smart and good at wordplay and, you know, is putting multiple meanings into everything he says in a way that a lot of the other characters are not. And that comes from Steve Martin. You know, this man was a very successful stand-up for a reason. He knows what to do with language and he knows when to rely on language versus when to rely on physicality.
Gosh, and come to think of it, it is actually a really cool thing, too, that in the movie, CD and Roxanne are both really intelligent, and they prove their intelligence, but they have different kinds of intelligence, too. I hadn't really thought about that, but that's so cool that he's very much, like, literary, and she is, too, but she's a scientist, you know? They have these sort of different competencies. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and I like that the woman is the scientific and mathematically minded one, and the man is the poet. That's a nice inversion of what you usually get. It's not unheard of, but it doesn't happen as often.
Yeah, you're 100% right. Gosh, I hate to say a phrase like this is an intellectual's rom-com because is that a thing? But maybe this is.
If anything is, it's this. Absolutely.
It's like this and When Harry Met Sally, I guess. Give a shout out to our patrons on Patreon and keep the show going, and especially our romantic leads, who are Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey. You're wonderful. I would just write you a letter to tell you. I wouldn't lie about it. I would write it myself. That's how much I love you.
We would even sign our own names.
Our own names. Oh, and speaking of, actually, we owe you guys some Valentine's, so look out for those this month.
Yeah, that's one of the many fun perks that you can get if you go to our Patreon and become a patron and a member of the Killjoys family. go check it out, and also like us on all of our various social media. All right. Well, I think it is safe to say that this movie does not require any antidotes.
Yeah, this is, I don't think I have liked a movie this much since we talked about When Harry Met Sally with our panel of lovely guests. So I'm very impressed.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite romantic movies. It's pretty great. And it is genuinely really sincere, but also very, very funny.
Well, so what would you suggest that our listeners supplement their viewing of Roxanne with? Because I will actually tell you, and you know I never do this, guys, I recommend you watch this movie.
Yes, I recommend you watch Roxanne. So if you haven't, that's my first recommendation just off the bat. But what I was thinking about Steve Martin and how lovely he is in this movie, and I would like to recommend another really lovely movie he's in that I think has a very similar sort of wholesome but incredibly funny, almost family friendly with just enough dirty jokes thrown in that it's not technically by today's standards type of movie. And that is the movie Parenthood. It's from 1989, and it's what the TV show Parenthood is based on, but they are two very different entities. And if you haven't seen Parenthood, the movie, it has a phenomenal cast. It's about a family and various adult siblings and their kids all interacting. And it stars Steve Martin, but it's also got Mary Steenburgen and Diane Wiest in one of her funniest performances, Rick Moranis, an incredibly young Martha Plimpton, and Keanu Reeves, who's like 20, and he's so funny in it. And the whole movie is just sort of about this large family full of aunts and uncles and cousins all sort of going through the hilarities of life, teenagers being teenagers and kids being kids and all the adults having midlife crises. But it's unbelievably funny, and it is so dear. And it's just another example of Steve Martin really kind of hitting the perfect intersection of his comedy and his likability. I think not long after this, he sort of went over the edge into a little too sort of clean cut, and you get like you're cheaper by the dozens and things like that when he's leaned too into that image and it doesn't really work as well. But this is right before that happens. This is when he's still sort of at peak Steve Martin. And I mean, I have watched this movie a million times and I laugh till my sides hurt every time. It is definitely worth a watch, and you will love seeing all of these actors being as young as they are in this movie. So I would suggest that. But Janelle, what do you recommend for us this week?
Well, my supplements for Roxanne are all theater history related. So sorry, anyone who was hoping I was going to do something not about theater, you are out of luck. But this gives me such an opportunity to talk about the late 19th century theater scene in Paris, which was bonkers, y'all. I don't know what it was about the late 19th century. I mean, I do. We could have a long conversation about the cultural forces that led to this. But French people were going absolutely buck wild. The stuff that was being made in La Belle Époque was wild. And, you know, Cyrano de Bergerac, the play, is actually like a very, like what we would maybe call like mainstream, very normal play that was being written at this time. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about, as my supplement, I want to recommend two pieces of theater or pieces of theater history that were like the shady underbelly of Paris at the exact same moment. And the first one is a play that premiered just a year before Cyrano de Bergerac, and that is Alfred Jarry's play King Ubu, or Ubu Roy, which caused a riot. The first word of the play is shit. It's wild. If you've never read it, you maybe shouldn't read it, actually. You should probably see it. I can recommend, and I will share this through our social media. There is a theater company in Washington, D.C. that I'm friendly with called Pointless Theater Company. Pointless Theater Company. And on their Vimeo channel, you can watch their 2016 production of the play. And it is hilarious, brilliant, dark, wild. You would not believe it was released the same year as Cyrano de Bergerac.
That video end in a riot, Janelle?
I mean, maybe. Watch it to find out.
Spoilers.
The other piece of Parisian theater history that I would direct you to, similar time, the year after Cyrano de Bergerac premiered in Paris, my favorite theater in the history of theater ever opened in Paris, the Théâtre du Grand Guignol, the famous theater of horror in Paris, where they did They developed the gore and stage violence techniques that were the foundation for the horror films that we love today. So things like blood packs and fake amputations on stage were developed at this theater. Everything we know about modern horror films, we owe for the most part to this theater. And there's an excellent YouTube video on it through the Crash Course channel called The Horrors of the Grand Guignol, Crash Course Theater number 35. I recommend watching it. It will blow your mind that this is what people in Paris were doing in the late 19th century at the same time as, like, you know, movies you love like Moulin Rouge and Midnight in Paris. But all of those things, I promise you, were indeed happening at the same time, sometimes blocks apart. So, you know, enjoy those little supplements from theater history.
Aw, I love theater history with Janelle. It's much darker than theater history with other people.
It inevitably is.
Gotta get that blood and gore in there.
That's what I'm about. Hey, you know, that's why they pay me the small bucks to talk to people about theater gore.
Well, you can hear us talk some more about theater gore in following weeks. So talk to you next week, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time. Starts and kissing and making up.